Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, Julian shares his perspectives on adoption from his own story of being adopted as a 7-year-old boy. This is a personal account from Julian, and please be mindful that some aspects of it may be upsetting, so listen with caution. We do hope you find it helpful and thought-provoking, and if you'd like to share your perspective or experience, then please do direct messages at our Twitter feed or on our Facebook page.
My name is Julian Thompson. I am an adult adoptee. I was adopted when I was 7, back in 1999. It feels like forever ago now. And I think it's fair to say the context of adoption in that time has changed. We've seen quite a lot of changes in the adoption process. But I think what we haven't seen really is a change in the way adoption makes people feel. And we haven't seen a change really in the impact of adoption, both on adoptees but also on adoptive parents, and actually I would argue to some degree more importantly birth parents. I think birth parents are the people who probably lose the most as a result of adoption, and I don't think that is appreciated enough both within the community and at a government and policy level. So what I'm going to talk about today is just give a little bit of background about my adoption, why I was released for adoption, and my adoption itself, a little bit of discussion about the process and some of my feelings around being adopted, and a little bit about that experience. And also I want to end by talking by giving a message of hope, talking about what my hope for the future is. So I hope that gives sort of a bit of a clear understanding about the parameters of what I'll talk about today. So I was born in April 1992, up in a place called Inverness, which is in the north of Scotland, not as far north as you can go, but quite north. It's quite cold and wet up there. I was born into an alcoholic home, so there was a lot of alcoholism, a lot of domestic violence. And there were several quite deeply entrenched issues that were going on that I've only subsequently found out as an adult, and I don't think this is the platform to go into them. But also, I would say that my family was incredibly traumatised, and you know, there was abuse was endemic within my context. So as a child, I would say I was very I was brought up into a very unsettled way of life, and I never really settled in one place. So we moved to Dundee quite quickly after I was born. We lived in homeless accommodation, me and my mum. We lived in quite a rough council estate. I remember when we moved in there. I don't remember when we moved in, but I remember living there. And I just remember feeling a sense of trepidation throughout my childhood, a sense of that I was never really quite safe. Like there was always something to be scared of. Which, for me, in the way that I dealt with this, I became this very hyper-compliant child, and I also became a massive control freak. At the age of 4, I remember going to nursery, and you know, I was always trying to make sure that everybody was doing what they were doing, and make sure everybody was in their, you know, requisite places, because if things weren't the way they were meant to be, I found that really difficult and really confusing. And so, for example, if my mum was late picking me up from nursery, I would find that really unsettling, and you know, I had this massive fear of abandonment. But I now understand that to be probably related to attachment issues and difficulties that my mum had attaching to me, and I would say as a result of that, my difficulties attaching to my mum. As a result of that, I became quite a hyper-compliant child as well. I became compliant because to not comply meant getting into trouble, and there was a lot of violent men around who would cause harm. So, and having spent a lot of time around those people, it would be very unsafe, or in my view, unsafe for me to cause too many problems, or as I would have saw it then, cause too many problems or rock the boat too much. And because in my case, that meant either my mum getting hurt or me getting hurt. So I would say that I was adopted when I was seven. I was in and out of care quite a lot. I personally don't really see a huge difference between adoption and care. I would say that the outcomes that we see tend to be quite similar. I would say that the issues that we see and the emotional and developmental barriers that we see in both being in care and adoption are similar. I think the goals are probably quite different, but the outcomes don't necessarily change. So I was put into a longer foster term placement at the age of five. There had been quite a lot of physical violence in house, and there was concern for both myself and my brother's well-being. So we were removed, and it was decided at some point on that 2 year period that I was in care that adoption would be the best option to give me a more permanent way of life, as it were. The question that's arisen in my head right now is, do I agree that that was the right thing? As an adult, would I agree that that was the right thing? And it's a very strange question, because I can't answer it, because I will never know. You know, there's not a question I can really answer. And I guess that creates quite a lot of confusion, because that's not something I can answer. I can't say, you know, do I think that being adopted was in my best interest? That was something I had to leave up to the professionals to decide. So there's quite a sense of disempowerment with that. A sense of feeling that perhaps, to what extent did I deserve to be heard and listened to and asked questions about that? And to what extent did that mean anything? Like, was my voice really center, like front and center of what happened? Or was I just told what to do and done it? And was that idea of participation and inclusion tokenistic? I don't know.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that... Yeah. We know that children's wishes are heard and seen, and that's what we would hope for. But actually, my first question is, well, how, as you're describing this really little boy, how capable is he of articulating what he wants?
No. So my answer to
this may be a hypothetical question, but any 5-year-old, how well can they articulate what they want, what they feel, and what they understand of what's being asked of them?
So what I would say is that my understanding and so there has never been any doubt in my mind that the behaviour of adults in my childhood was wrong.
Yeah.
So I've always understood the difference between right and wrong, and I've always understood that I was scared as a child. So I knew... There was no hiding from the fact that you know, I had experienced some things that social workers may never experience in their lives. So I had lived through the thing that they were trying to make decisions on. So I would say that actually what their job should have been was to create a place where I felt able to say what I wanted, needed to say, and to feel safe. And I have this memory of not feeling safe. Speaking to the adults at that time, I didn't feel... I thought that if I was honest about things, then I would get into more trouble and be more hurt. So I was in this cycle and, you know, this sort of spiral of trauma and fear. And we understandably know a lot more today about trauma and about ACEs and about all that stuff. But for me, I've always known that stuff because I lived it, you know, like this stuff that we're starting to realize about the science of trauma and the science of ACEs, I've known for a very long time because I lived it. you know. So I almost sometimes it gets a bit underwhelming when people are like, look, what we discovered, these aces, and then it's like, well, yeah, but you know, and we, surely we know that, you know, it's not rocket science. It's really interesting looking at the psychology of stuff, but if you hurt a child, of course they're going to be scared, do you know what I mean? Things are going to be bad, and you know, the science makes it seem fancy and sort of it almost makes it a fad, and I hate to use that word, but it does. It's like aces are kind of like a policy buzzword just now, I think. But actually, it's just common sense.
Yeah, well, no, I do training on adverse childhood experience aces. I deliver it, and my opening line is: this next couple of hours is the bleeding obvious. There's not one person who's going to... Hopefully, there'll be no one at the end of these 2 hours who goes, well, who'd have thought? Early adversity causes latest problems in life. You know, if you've worked with children for more than 6 weeks, then you kind of, you've worked that one out.
Yeah.
You'd hope.
So to answer your question in a roundabout way, I think that the job of professionals was to understand and to hear and to listen first before making decisions, and if those decisions took longer to make, fine, but I think there was decisions made based on other priorities, and my, you know, I think, and I think it's just a rule of life: if you ever want to find out the root of a problem, follow the money, you know. To keep me in care was expensive, to keep children in care is expensive, you know. And I understand that. I wouldn't say that I have any strong feelings about that, because I understand the necessity of it, and that for budget considerations to always be important. But to what extent do we place them above the well-being of children? You know, I think that it doesn't cost anything to listen. It doesn't cost anything to be curious. You know, these things that we could change, you know, or that could have changed in my situation, were very much, you know, they didn't cost much. You know, all they required was a little bit of effort and imagination.
So do you recall those conversations and sort of the understanding that actually you are going to be adopted? Is that something you can recall?
I recalled, yes, I do, and I remember doing to work through this cartoon thing, like a cartoon book of explaining about a boy who was being adopted, and it was almost like they infantilized my adoption, so they sort of gave me this book to try and understand adoption, and I just remember this overwhelming thought of, oh, he looks like he's got a nice life, and this seems very nice and too perfect. You know, children are not stupid. So when you give them something that looks too good to be true, they're automatically suspicious. But I was, one thing I had become very good at from a very young age was hiding my feelings, hiding the way I felt. So you wouldn't have thought as a child that I would have any issues or that there was anything going on unless you knew how to look. How to listen, you know. If you weren't looking for it, you wouldn't have seen it. But if you were, you would have seen it. You know, you would have seen. There's a couple of things I can remember in my childhood that were quite out of character behaviours for me, that people just thought were oddities, and there was wasn't taken too seriously. I remember this one time, this guy had hit me in my foster home, so I went and hit him back. And I don't do that. I'm not a very violent person, but I just remember being really, really angry, and hitting him back quite hard. And it was very out of character. I was a little boy, you know, so I don't hold it against myself too much.
Yeah,
but yeah. You know, and I would like. I would just do some crazy things, like we had a blackboard in my foster home, and I used to. This is one time I wrote swear words on the blackboard, And I was, but I just remember, I want to know how that feels. I want to know how it feels to swear and to express myself in this difficult way, you know? Because for me, swearing actually helped me. You know, it helped me to express something. It helped me to express the way I really felt. And there was only one person I can remember who ever helped me to do that. And they weren't a social worker, they were a friend of my mum's, who made it okay for me to be honest. And when we'd, like, I think as professionals, I count myself as a professional in that, we want things to be easy. We want to wrap children up in nice packages and send them off somewhere nice. But that's not the reality. The reality is life is messy. The reality is adoption and care, childcare, foster care is messy. It isn't. And when we try and fit children into that, what we think is easy, I think we tend to do more harm than good. Instead of accepting the fact that it's difficult and there's going to be difficult times, and, you know, we try and, or certainly this has been my experience, try and fit children into what makes our lives easier. And so therefore children become, I use this word cautiously, inconvenient. So therefore the children and children's behaviour is actually inconvenient to the social care system, because it doesn't follow a set of procedures, or it doesn't meet a set of outcomes, or it doesn't meet budget requirements. You know, the system is governed by different rules to what children are governed by. So yeah. I would say that, so that sort of covers my period in care, I hope, and my sort of experiences of that. What I will say, however, to top all that off, is that I did not have a terrible experience of care. I would say that I could probably count on one hand the sort of adversity that happened in care, which was quite poor. To for example, the person who had caused, who was the violent person in my life, was a Schedule 1 offender, I think they call them. Is it Schedule 1 offender? I don't know. It's different in Scots law, I think. And I was allowed to have continued contact with him whilst I was in care. And that was that. Looking on that as an adult, I'm like, oh my God, that was stupid, you know?
Especially when you describe yourself as a child who lived with fear.
Yes.
That means that foster care then is not a place that's safe from that fear. That fear doesn't end.
So I would say I think a lot of my life has been spent in limbo, of not quite knowing, sort of not quite being safe, but not being unsafe either, but constantly on the sort of the vigilant cliff edge of safety.
Yeah,
constantly sort of watch, or hyper alert, maybe it would be a sort of the scientific word to use. So then we move on to my adoption. And so my life has been characterized by this idea of everything is an adventure. And that was, I think that was a fantasy I concocted for myself to help me feel safe. I think when I went into foster care more permanently, I saw it as an adventure. And I just remember this in my head. I remember this sort of imagining that I was off to New York or, you know, somewhere like that. And I was going to me village in Fife, you know, and it was really quite underwhelming, but I had this sort of, I thought I wanted someone to come and save me. I think it was like this sort of Oliver Twist sort of novel. You know, the more I sort of go into this stuff, the more I understand Oliver Twist and the story, and I'm like, maybe Charles Dickens was adopted, you know. It was Charles Dickens who wrote Oliver
Twist.
It was,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, it was definitely.
And you know, so I had sort of expected this sort of, you know, going off to this sort of glamorous life, and you know, imagine my disappointment when I went into this little village and, you know, there was cheese on toast for supper, and you know, so
very normal,
you know. But normal was scary because I didn't know what normal was, so even that was weird. Like, that year was my first Christmas I'd ever had, which was quite overwhelming. And so quite a lot of people like Christmas, right?
Yeah.
But I only had my first Christmas when I was five. So Christmas is not a kind of a known event for me, because I, from a very young age, I haven't, it's not been indoctrinated into me that that's what happened. So I can, do you know what, I'd quite happily sit and do nothing on Christmas. It doesn't
resonate with you.
Resonate to it, because it's not ingrained to the extent that it's maybe ingrained with other people. Mm. I was just told that my parents couldn't afford, like Santa, I was told Santa couldn't come down our chimney because we had a gas fire and could, and nobody could afford presents. So that, so yeah. In care was when I had, so I was really overwhelmed. I just remember feeling really overwhelmed and quite giddy actually, and getting quite, maybe quite high off the sort of the fumes of Christmas. And it being this, oh my God, look at all these toys. But it didn't seem to ever be enough either. Like it was almost like a, I don't know, like it didn't quite fill the hole that had been left in many ways. It just seemed a bit fake, or a bit, it didn't seem real, or, you know, I don't know. It just seemed to be another fantasy thing that I could get my head into. And Santa never really gave me what I wanted either, because I wanted to be like magic myself away to this amazing, like,
yeah,
magic place. I loved magic and I loved fantasy. And Santa never gave me that stuff, you know. Santa could never transport me out of my life, you know. And I suppose in a lot of ways that's what I wanted, because I wanted to go to a place where I could feel indefinitely safe, I guess. So the adoption process in itself wasn't for me a huge difficulty. I met these people and I loved meeting new people and still do to this day. And this was someone who I could call mum, and I guess I spent my life trying to make my mum be my mum. And you know, it's taken that into an adulthood and a deeper acceptance, I guess, that she's not, you know. And that's not to say she's not my mum in a different way, but she's not the woman that gave birth to me, and she, you know, that we have a different relationship.
Yeah.
And that's been a difficult, I would say that has required careful negotiation. Because it's almost trying to, I think adoption in some ways is trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because you've got this child and you're both trying to fit into each other's lives. You both have different expectations. And I guess I had this expectation that I would just be living this life that was very different to the way it turned out. And I would say that there was no problems or no noticeable problems until I got to about 11 years old. When I suddenly, I think at the age of 11, I suddenly started to, I probably hit puberty and started to grow up and was capable of more complex thought. And I just remember the sort of one sort of thing in my head of not being able to understand how I could love both mums at the same time. I didn't understand that. Right. And I didn't understand how I could have the capacity to, because this was how you loved one mum, but you needed to love this mum in a different way. And I didn't quite know how to do that. So that was a source of quite a bit of confusion. And I felt guilty about that as well. I felt quite guilty about not being able to somehow assimilate those emotions and those. And I also felt quite angry about that. I was very angry from the age of 11 onwards. I overnight became this horrible person to be around. To tell you the truth, I didn't enjoy being in my head at that time either.
Right.
What I understand today is I think there was a probably, I've been diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and I actually think that from the age of 11 it was probably an issue. But no one knew. I went to see counsellors and things, and everybody did what they thought was the best thing to do, but nobody really seemed to get it, you know. Nobody seemed to like there was issues that were big for me, and I just remember being overwhelmingly frustrated by the fact that no one just seemed to get this, you know. It's like, for me, it was like, well, I'm the bad person here, because I'm, you know, it was like I was being punished for the way that I was feeling, like I was the one that had to go to counseling. And that's why I think that we don't support adoptive parents enough, because somehow they're just left to get on with it, and that isn't necessarily helpful. And I actually don't think that's helpful for the child, really. I think that the system doesn't provide adoptees or adoptive parents with a safety net or a very good safety net. And if it does, the safety net is quite really have very much, it's not very safe. I think that social work, especially, I would argue social work in the UK, especially in Scotland, has become very much a, it's become, if you're losing a leg or you're about to die, then you'll maybe see a social worker. But if that's not, if you're just having general problems, it's not really our responsibility, you know.
A threshold to get any sort of level of meaningful support. High.
Which I think you need. So I remember seeing my social worker once after my adoption, a few years afterwards, just because I was starting to be quite difficult and my mum had reached out. And I've since looked at my social work file, and this particular social worker, there was an email exchange between the social worker and her manager, and it says, "We take our post-adoption responsibilities quite seriously." And I laughed at that because I thought, that just that written in that time and that context, it's laughable, because actually what we know now is that wasn't sufficient. You know, we know now today that that wasn't sufficient, but they thought it was. So I can't hold it against anyone too much, you know, because I understand that we can only do our best with the tools and the resources that we have. So that leads me, I think, quite nicely onto what my hopes for the future are. And I think that adoptees and adoptive parents, they should have more rights. You know, if I was born into a family and was raised normally, there would be absolutely no conditions on my life. It would be, you know, there would be, like, my life has been governed by conditions and processes and forms and procedures and legal bits. And, you know, there's been very much, love has been a condition of fulfilling certain criteria. That's been my experience of love. Mm-hmm. And my experience of being a son and a brother and a foster kid and, you know, all this stuff. So the right, I would argue that there, I have a right to be loved unconditionally. And we don't, and I think in Scotland we're making a step change in that direction. We're starting to put love at the heart of the care system. And I think if we're going to make any change, it needs to start in the care system, because I think once we do that, we will start to see a shift in adoption, because I think adoption is probably quite secondary to care. I think most children will have been in care or adopted these days. Yeah. So I think putting love at the heart of the care system, and that every child has the right to be loved and the right to be cared for and the right to not have conditions put on that love being given. I think adoption needs to be much more flexible. It needs to, and I think we're moving in that direction, but I don't think well enough. Adoption is I hate the word permanence. Permanence implies that it's permanent and done and dusted and that's it.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I think that means that gives too much power to people. That means it's too nothing in life, I have found, is unchangeable. I can't make it, like, there's no decision I can make is not a decision I can change, really. You know, I am able to make decisions and change them if they're not the right ones. And I think adoption might be controversial, but I think adoption is no different. Just because you've made a decision, I think a lot of adoptive parents, in many ways, if they had the flexibility to change that adoption, or to change the way that adoption works or looks or feels, or even if it exists, I think it would cause a lot less trauma. Not only for children, but I think if you've got a problem in an adoptive family, you know, you'll have some adoptions that clearly just shouldn't have happened. They shouldn't be working. There's no adoption. There's no test period. Do you know what I mean? You know, there's no, you know, try before you buy. There's no 14-day guarantee, you know. And that sounds quite silly, I think, what I'm saying. But there's no, it's too permanent. And I think around all of that, around those more rights, more flexibility, I think that we all need to foster a deeper understanding of the implications of adoption. I think we need to understand much more about the realities. It's not just about getting a kid. It's about raising a very traumatized kid. You know, it's about adoption shouldn't be the route to getting a child. It should be the route to helping kids. You know, like the I think we need to flip how we view it. You know, because it's traditionally been the route that adults going to get children, and you know, yeah. I've always described it feeling like a sack of potatoes that you're going to someone goes and buys. You know, but what adoption in its current form fails to understand is that both of those parties are traumatized in some way. Parents are traumatized. Adoptive parents are traumatized. They may or may not have been able to have children. They have experienced loss. And also, I think I spoke to you not so long ago, Al, about this, about, you know, adoptive parents will comply with the questions that they are asked. If an adoptive parent is asked if they would mind if their child was gay or trans, they're not going to say, you know, yes or no. They're going to answer, of course not, we don't care, because they want the child. They, you know,
that is the right answer.
Yeah, it is very possible to engineer an adoption to suit you, but as is life, it's very possible to engineer your life to suit yourself. You know, so but so my aspirations for the future, I guess, is to create systemic change to improve the life outcomes for adoptees. And I think that, in a nutshell, is my aspiration for the future. And I don't know what that looks like. I guess that looks like what I had said previously about having more rights and more flexibility, fostering a deeper understanding culturally, personally, professionally, around what that looks. What that looks like. I think we need social workers to be less professional, for want of a better word. Do you know what? It's a paradox, because in being more, I think if social workers were less professional, they could actually achieve more. But in doing so, they deprofessionalize their staff. Like there's so many standards and rules and regulations and things, that hoops that you need to jump through. And it's like, sometimes I wonder if we've just regulated childcare too much. And I know that it's all about keeping children safe, but like, is the amount of regulation that we have around social work directly correlated to the amount of harm that is either caused or not caused by those regulations, or the lack of them? You know, sometimes I wonder if, and that might be quite a controversial thing to say, but I mean, like, the government tends to step in and go, well, here's the knee-jerk reaction of the week to help stop children being harmed. And then you have, so for example, and I'm just pulling two out of a hat, you had a commission and a report that was done after the death of Victoria Columbia, back in the 90s, it was before my time, so I can't remember. 90s. And then 90s, and then you've got BBP. So so it's like, we love heads to roll and we love accountability, but sometimes things just happen, and it's actually more about, the issue is not creating more regulations. The issue is actually, it's like the government needs to be seen to be doing something.
Yeah.
But actually, it's the person who committed the crime that's the problem, not the system.
I mean, that's a big conversation, isn't it? Because those whose desire is to perpetrate crimes will always be looking for gaps.
Yes. Is it fair to say, well, the social work department could have prevented that from happening? If the social work department knew, yes, it was there. You know, they had a right to do that. If they didn't know, well, maybe, you know. And I also think we're just terrible in this country at talking about harming children. Even if we suspect it's too horrific to raise as a concern.
Yeah.
And if we're wrong, God help us. Do you know what I mean? Like, the one in the community will hate us. But, you know, it's... can you imagine you've made this allegation against someone and then it's wrong? And then, yeah.
No, you've raised some interesting points, and I think that your aspiration to alter the adoption system, you inhabit this position where you've lived it, but also you're very articulate and you're very self-aware. You're not coming as a burn this, you know, we're not looking to burn the building to the ground. You're looking to...
Not yet.
You may be looking to burn it down and build something better, but yeah. Or perhaps renovate. I don't know. Maybe yeah. I'm not going to go too far down that metaphor because it's clearly very, very bad. But I really enjoyed talking to you. We've had lots of conversations. This is just like about 10% of our conversations, isn't it? So I really appreciate you giving your time and sharing with us. You know, what is a really personal story and some really very, very personal aspects of your own life and your own experience. So thank you very much. And where can people find you if they want to find you online?
So they can go onto my website, which is www.re-connected.co.uk, or you can send me an email at julian@reconnected, with the hyphen between re and connected.co.uk.
Excellent. Well, so thank you very much for your time, Julian. That's been wonderful.
You're very welcome.